And I ask, you can be seated. So good morning. We are here in our Learning to Lead series, just starting that today. I'll talk about that in just a second, but I want to start, boo for Denver Bronco fans, but I want to start for, I know, I'm related so I can say that. I want to start by asking a question. If you were to kind of answer this for yourself, what would you say? One of the best leaders I have followed is, who would you say? Like you could talk about work or home or a sports team or a club you're a part of or something at school or whatever it is. So think of all kinds of contexts, whatever they are, however old you are, however young you are. But when you think of somebody who had some sort of leadership role in your life, whether it's formal, maybe they were your boss, maybe it was a coach, maybe, or whatever, just somebody in your life who kind of played that role, regardless of how old you are or how young you are, who would come to mind? But the second question I want you to ask in your head is not just who would come to mind, but why did they come to mind? What was it about that person, or is it about that person, that causes you to think of them when I ask the question, who is one of the best leaders? Does that kind of make sense, what I'm saying there? Take 30 seconds, talk to the people around you, and ask them that question. Who would you say some of the best leaders are that you have ever followed, and why? So just talk with the people around you, turn around, you may have to, whatever, look to somebody who doesn't have someone else near them. Ask people around you. If you see somebody sitting by themselves, ask them that question. Okay, whoop, yeah, I'm still on. Anybody, I'm not going to ask you to shout out their names, but just shout out why it is, what is it about that person that you thought about, that you caused you to think that they were a good leader? Clearly it's not a good communicator like me. So what is it about somebody that caused you to say, hey, you know what, I think this person's a good leader. What is it about them? Just shout it out loud. And shout out loud enough that I can hear it up here. He teaches, yeah, someone who teaches, yeah, totally. What else? Integrity, yeah. Leads by example, yeah. Someone who cares. Oh, someone who has passion, yeah. Devotion. If we had time, we could probably go all throughout and just get all kinds of ideas of what good leaders are. There are many ways to talk about leadership. If you've ever gone to any sort of leadership seminar or read any kind of leadership book, everybody's got a theory on what good leadership is or what, you know, the six core elements or the 10 whatever characteristics. There's all kinds of ways of looking at what good leadership is. What we're going to do for this series is look at leadership, but we're looking at it through the lens of the book of Nehemiah or the character of Nehemiah. And to do that, we're asking kind of seven questions or looking at seven different areas. Now, you're going to hear me say there are times when a leader must, but this actually applies to all of us. This applies just as much to life for every single person in this room as it does to any leader. It's just sometimes the consequences are higher for a leader, that's all, in terms of the influence that they have. But there are times when all of us, and we'll look at Nehemiah here, when all of us must pray. And that's today. We're going to look at the connection between prayer and leadership, and then I'm going to argue actually prayer in all of us. It doesn't matter what our roles are, but there's a time when each of us probably should be praying. So there are times when a leader must pray. There are times when a leader must start. Things don't magically happen by themselves. At some point, somebody needs to start something. What's the role of leadership with that? Third one is, sometimes we have to resist. Now, you don't have to live very long to realize sometimes there are forces, conversations, people, opportunities that kind of crash in on you that you have to resist. We're going to look at that. Well, the fourth one is sometimes we have to remember, then sometimes we have to confess, sometimes we have to recommit, and then sometimes we have to celebrate. So those are the seven pictures we're looking at in terms of leadership. Again, we could go all over the place. Those are the seven we're picking because those are the seven that seem to come out pretty clearly in the story of Nehemiah and the book of Nehemiah. That's where we're going in the big picture. Now, to do that, though, we kind of need to step back and say, so who in the world is Nehemiah? Why are we talking about him? Where did he come from? What's going on? Like, this conversation that we're going to have the next 7 weeks makes no sense if we don't have a bit of a picture of who Nehemiah is and the world that he kind of arose out of, so we can start to put the pieces together. To do that, I'm going to show you a wonderfully hand-drawn picture that I did this week. That's about the extent of my artistic skill. My family would verify that of all, when, you know, certain skills were handed out to certain people, the artistic one in terms of drawing and art and whatever, didn't really land in my lap. But this line, anybody know what this line symbolizes? I heard somebody say, like, life, right? Kind of life goes up and down, leadership goes up and down, life goes up and down. Again, doesn't take long to live before you realize, you know what, sometimes there are low points in life, sometimes there are high points. They're not always a nice pattern like this, but there are highs and there are lows. And what I want to do is just in a couple minutes here, very quickly, paint a little bit of the highs and the lows that led up to Nehemiah, so that when we look at Nehemiah, we go, oh, okay, that explains why whatever it is we're going to look at. So to start off with, we need to go back in time. We need to go back in time almost 2,600 years. Go back to the year 587 or 586 BCE. So that's a long time ago. And the context of this very quickly is that the ancient people of Israel, specifically the people around the capital city of Jerusalem and kind of that surrounding area, they were actually attacked and overrun by the great Babylonian Empire in 587, 586. There's all kinds of history there, and we'll kind of skip that for now. But for our purposes, what happened was when Jerusalem got attacked, the Babylonians destroyed the place and took not everybody, but a lot of people into exile back into Babylon. And so not only did they destroy the city, they took all the people, most of the people, out of it and took them away, so that Jerusalem was sitting there destroyed, not a lot of people, in really, really rough shape. That happened in 587, a very low point in the life of Israel, right? Because they just got destroyed, basically. A few years later, about 50 years later, and so at this point now, the Persian Empire had overthrown the Babylonian Empire in terms of world history, and Cyrus, one of the Persian kings, said, you know what? I'm actually going to let some people go back to their hometowns. Now, before you go, oh, what a nice guy this Persian king was. Really, he was a little more strategic than that, because he's realizing of all the countries that we conquered, if all of their major cities are sitting in ruins, that's not really accomplishing a whole lot. How about we send people back to their cities, they can rebuild them, get them economically strong again, and then I'll tax them and have this nice supply of money. And so we sent people back to these cities so that they would grow and they would thrive, and then ultimately he would tax them. So that was a high point in a sense, because the people then, some of them, were allowed to go back to their hometown, back to Jerusalem, start to rebuild it, start to put things back together. But unfortunately, as history showed, it wasn't easy. There was internal conflict. There was external stuff oppressing them, and it wasn't very good. In fact, it kind of sunk back downhill again, and so they went down into a low. But then in the year 516, 515, so about 70 years after they were in exile, and I'll show you a map in a second to see how far away they went. It's actually pretty amazing how far exile was away from where they lived. What happened in 516, 515 was the temple in Jerusalem was rebuilt. Now, for us may not be a big deal. For them, a huge big deal, because the city of Jerusalem was the capital of the empire. It symbolized everything, their power, their strength, their belief that God loved them. If the city did well, then God must love them. And in that place, though, was the temple, and the temple signified the presence of God. So the temple in Jerusalem was the most important place in all of Judaism, and here it was rebuilt. So that was a high point. If you're a real kind of history nerd or Bible nerd, that's the start of what's called Second Temple Judaism. It goes to about 70 AD or 70 CE. And that's the span within which Jesus lived and all that kind of stuff. So that was great. But what happened is it kind of went downhill again. And there was more instability. The walls were still broken around the city, and more infighting and oppression, all kind of stuff. So it kind of sunk back down. From that, then, these reports find their way to Nehemiah. Nehemiah is the person we're looking at in this story. So all these bad things happen, the reports get to Nehemiah, and then what happens is this other high point, where Ezra and Nehemiah together, we're just going to look at Nehemiah, they start to rebuild the city, and everything kind of starts to get put back together again. So what we're looking at is this right in here, this era, where all this, you know, one of the lows, it's all a mess, his reports get to Nehemiah, he steps up in terms of leadership, and the people rise to one of those high peaks again. So that's the context of the story we're looking at, the series that we're looking at. Nehemiah taking this broken, messed up place, and in large part to his leadership, it starts to emerge stronger, healthier, and more effective. So that's the kind of the really quick background to the picture or to the story of Nehemiah. That being said, enough background, let's jump in. So if you have a Bible, turn to Nehemiah chapter 1. If you don't know where Nehemiah is, because often, you know, people don't spend time in Nehemiah, kind of open the Bible to the middle and then go back a little bit towards the beginning. You'll find Nehemiah in there. If you have your phone, obviously you can just scroll and find Nehemiah or whatever, but find Nehemiah chapter 1. And then we will jump in and read it. If you're the kind of person who likes to follow along, and the handout too that you had the option to pick up when you came in, there's about three or four blanks that you can fill in that kind of will capture the high points if you like to do that. And if you don't know that we do that, most Sundays we have a handout that has blanks and stuff that, like, you know, it fills in the key points so you can kind of track things and learn that way. If that works for you. So Nehemiah chapter 1. Let's jump in right away. The words of Nehemiah, son of Hakaliah. So everything we're reading is kind of him telling his own story. The words of Nehemiah, son of Hakaliah. In the month of Kislev, in the 20th year, while I was in the citadel of Susa, I'll stop there for a second. I'll go back in a minute and unpack those things because you're going, what? Kislev? Where does that fit in January, February, March? I'll tell you that. So in the month of Kislev, in the 20th year, while I was in the citadel of Susa, Hanani, one of my brothers, came from Judah with some other men. And I questioned them about the Jewish remnant that had survived the exile and also about Jerusalem. So, big story. He's in exile. Some people from his hometown come in there and he's like, oh, tell me what's going on. Like, I haven't been there. So, like, I'm in exile. Tell me what's happening in Jerusalem, in Judah. I want to know. That's my hometown. That's our hometown. What's going on there? A couple quick things to unpack. Kislev is like November, December, that time of year. The 20th year is the 20th year of King Artaxerxes. So that's about 445 BCE. So 450, 440 years before Jesus, just to kind of put it in perspective. And Susa is a city in what now is modern Iran. And here's a picture. So you can see here, hopefully you can, there's Jerusalem over there, Israel, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, Iran, Saudi Arabia's down here. That little, whatever that marker is called, that's the capital city, the winter capital of the Persian Empire called Susa. Now, to give you a bit of a sense of what that distance is, if you were to travel straight line from Jerusalem over to Susa, which you would never do in real life because that's just barren desert, you'd always travel up what's called the Fertile Crescent. But if you were to go straight there, that's about 1,000, 1,200 kilometers. It'd be equivalent, now this is all walking, remember this, right? When you're taken into exile from your country, put somewhere else, you're not taking a plane or a bus or whatever, you're walking. It'd be equivalent to leaving Prince George and walking to Yellowknife in the Northwest Territories. So this is a hike. This is not a, oh yeah, we'll go over, like he's a long ways away. The other way you could do it, if you went in Prince George and just started going east, you cross all of BC, cross all of Alberta, kind of dip down into southern Saskatchewan and get near the Manitoba border by foot. So this is a long, long journey. So it's a big deal that people came back to see him. Just in terms of Susa as well, if you're wondering where else that fits in the Bible, Daniel has a vision of something that takes place in Susa, and then the whole story of Esther takes place in the capital city of Susa. So it gives you a bit of a context for Susa there. Anyway, so there's the background. And as we continue the story, so Nehemiah's there. Hey, what's going on back in Jerusalem? Nehemiah had probably never been to Jerusalem. What's going on in our homeland? And these people had taken this long journey to get there. What's happening? And here's what they say. They said to me, those who have survived the exile and are back in the province are in great trouble and disgrace. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down, and its gates have been burned with fire. When I heard these things, I sat down and wept. The first of the three principles we're going to see this morning is that great leaders understand the situation. Nehemiah realized that if the walls are broken down and if the gate is burnt, that means the city is absolutely defenseless. is completely vulnerable. There's nothing they can do to stop anybody from taking them over again. They are at everybody's mercy. It's not just, oh, you know, the walls are broken, we need to hire some carpenters and some stonemasons to put it together or rebuild. It wasn't just a simple project management issue. He understood the situation, that the safety, the future of the whole city, and actually maybe even the region because of the role of Jerusalem, was at stake. Great leaders always understand the situation. They see what it is, they understand the significance of it. And when Nehemiah heard this and saw this, he understood how significant it was. Leaders understand the significance of the situation. The story continues. For some days, this is, again, Nehemiah still speaking, I mourned and fasted and prayed before the God of heaven. Then I said, and this is cool because this is a big extended prayer that's recorded from Nehemiah. Then I said, Lord, the God of heaven, the great and awesome God who keeps his covenant of love with those who love him and keep his commandments, let your ear be attentive and your eyes open to hear the prayer your servant is praying before you day and night for your servants, the people of Israel. I confess the sins we Israelites, including myself and my father's family, have committed against you. Now stop for a second. This is for 130 years after the exile. So Nehemiah was never in Jerusalem. Nehemiah's sins never actually caused anything. But still, he's associating himself with the sinfulness of the people. In our Western cultures, how often do we say, oh, it wasn't me, right? We don't care about anything else. We disconnect ourselves from anybody else as soon as we can because we didn't do it. Here's Nehemiah saying, no, there's a long history of me, my family, my people walking away from you. I need to own that. I confess the sins we Israelites, including myself, my father's family, have committed against you. We have acted very wickedly toward you. We have not obeyed the commands, decrees, and laws you gave your servant Moses. Remember the instructions you gave your servant Moses, Nehemiah continues, saying, so now he's quoting God, if you are unfaithful, I will scatter you among the nations. But if you return to me and obey my commands, then even if your exiled people are at the farthest horizon, I will gather them from there and bring them to the place I have chosen as a dwelling for my name. I love that verse, that phrase. Even if they are at the farthest horizons, no matter how far they are, no matter how far you and I run, drift, whatever it is, no matter how broken things are, no matter how many stupid things we do, if we return, God will take us back. That's one of the most powerful pictures, images, statements in the whole Bible. It doesn't matter how far, how desperate, how broken, how hopeless, how whatever, the farthest horizons, the farthest you can go, you come to me, I will still gather you back. Some of you here in this room right now need to hear that message. You are not too far from God. Then Nehemiah continues, they are your servants and your people, whom you redeemed by your great strength and your mighty hand. Lord, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of this your servant and to the prayer of your servants who delight in revering your name. And then he switches gears a little bit. Give your servant success today by granting him favor in the presence of this man. I was cupbearer to the king. So great leaders not only understand the situation, great leaders see more than the situation. Did you catch what Nehemiah was saying? He's saying, okay, yeah, these walls are broken down and the gates are burnt or whatever, but it's part of something so much bigger. He connects the pieces to what God has been doing, what God is doing, the way the people have acted and how there's still chance for change in the future. He sees the situation, but he sees so much more. He puts the situation in its proper context. Great leaders, in any context, at home, at work, wherever, in our own lives, have the amazing ability to see more than what just the situation is. Nehemiah saw that, and it made sense to him because he connected it with the whole story of God. What does that look? Here's a little example of seeing more at Westwood. How do you, you know, because for many of us, our perception of Westwood is right now. 60 minutes on a Sunday morning, maybe 62 or 65, or depending on how the service goes, right? But we have this one-hour chunk on a Sunday morning. That's actually a really small picture of what Westwood is all about. There is so much more for us to see. One really easy way to start to get that picture is you heard Holly talk about our annual general meeting at 1:30 this afternoon, just in a few hours from now. Depending on your history with other AGMs, maybe going, oh, it's so boring. Maybe not. I hope ours are a little bit different, because when you come to this one, you're going to hear stories of God at work. We're going to share stories of things that have happened on a Sunday morning in Prince George, around the world, to see the bigger picture, to see more than just this situation on a Sunday morning and get a glimpse of what God is doing all over the place. We're also going to approve, if we do, anyways, we're presenting a $904,000 budget. Now you may be going, what in the world do you do with $904,000? I've got a nice Mercedes. No, I don't. Here's what we do. I don't have a Toyota Tacoma, which is awesome, by the way. But so we often say bringing Jesus into life. When we say that, we talk about our whole mission, our whole goal, why we exist is for people to encounter Jesus in Westwood right now, in things that happen in this context, but also in the rest of Prince George, in Canada, around the world. Some of those things are Alpha, which you heard Holly mention as well, an amazing course that is all about helping us discover who Jesus really is, what it means to actually have a relationship with Jesus and with God. How does that work? Can you explain that in some sort of way that makes sense? Alpha does that. You may not know that we also, some of our funding goes to a network that we're a part of that plants new churches all around Canada, because we're not just about Prince George. We want Jesus to be into life everywhere. We also have all kinds of missions, and those of you who are involved in leadership already know all this stuff anyways. Local missions, international missions, we are involved in so many things locally and elsewhere. Curriculum, you know, what our children's ministry, our youth ministries, our small groups, we have all kinds of really good Jesus-focused, Bible-centered curriculum that some of those funds go to supply so that we can actually wrestle deeply with Scripture and with the world around us. We have a great recovery movement, been going on for a long time. All those things are part of the story of Westwood that are beyond this situation on Sunday mornings. Am I cutting in and out? Or is it just me that's hearing that? Oh, what do you know? It's me. So, because it's happened a couple times, yeah. Did you go like this or like this? So I invite you this afternoon to see beyond just 1 hour at Westwood. There's so much more than this. So let's go back to the story. So great leaders understand the situation. Great leaders see more than the situation. But the story continues. Nehemiah chapter 2, the next verse if you're reading along. Here's how it goes. In the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, just for reference, Nisan is about 4 months after Kislev, so about 4 months have passed. Nehemiah hears this stuff, it breaks his heart, he prays about it, and then 4 months later, this story happens. In the month of Nisan, 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was brought for him, I took the wine and gave it to the king. Remember, Nehemiah is the cupbearer. I had not been sad in his presence before, so the king asked me, "Why does your face look sad when you're not ill? In other words, what's wrong? This can be nothing but sadness of heart." Nehemiah gets instantly afraid, because when you're in the king's presence, everything should be happy and amazing because you're in the king's presence. But now the king realizes that Nehemiah is sad. He's going, oh no, if he thinks that I'm upset because I'm not happy in his presence, then I could die, because you're supposed to be happy in the king's presence. So Nehemiah starts to freak out a little bit here. "I was very much afraid, but I said to the king, 'May the king live forever. But why should my face not look sad when the city where my ancestors are buried lies in ruins and its gates have been destroyed by fire?' The king said to me, 'What is it you want?' Then I prayed to the God of heaven, and I answered the king, 'If it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in his sight, let him send me to the city of Judah where my ancestors are buried so that I can rebuild it.' Then the king, with the queen sitting beside him, asked me, 'How long will your journey take, and when will you get back?' It pleased the king, so I set a time." Great leaders understand the situation. Great leaders see more than the situation. And the third thing is that great Christian leaders pray beyond the situation. If you missed it in this story, there's a little line right up there. Well, you know, what is it you want? And then I answer the king right in the middle. Then I prayed to the God of heaven. I love that story, that little insertion, because in the previous chapter, we see Nehemiah's prayer, and it's theologically sophisticated, and it's eloquent, and it ties in history, and you go, man, that is an awesome prayer. If only we could all pray like that. Best prayer ever, Nehemiah. But then just a couple sentences later, here's this prayer, and I love this one because you kind of get the story. It happens this quickly. The king says, what do you want? Oh, God, please help me. Well, king, you know, and carries on. Like, you know how you have those instant, I just need help right now kind of prayers. Nothing about eloquence, nothing about whatever, but it's about complete dependence upon God. Those are powerful prayers because the strength of my prayer really has nothing to do with what I say or how eloquent it is. The strength of my prayer has everything to do with who I'm praying to and why I'm praying to him. Nehemiah got that. Great Christian leaders pray beyond the situation. They're not limited by that. They're not bound by that. And the other thing that Nehemiah did, he didn't pray for someone else to solve the problem or that it would get solved by itself. Nehemiah stepped up. Nehemiah acted. Great Christian leaders pray beyond the situation. So what do we do with all that? How do we take, you know, 26 or 2,500 years ago, all these different things, and how is this relevant today? Well, let me just make two statements. The first one is simply a question, and it's not really rocket science. It's pretty straightforward, but I think we need to ask ourselves. It's this: in what situation in my life right now, at school, grade 11, and university, at work, while I'm unemployed, on my sports team, at home, as I'm an entrepreneur, whatever it is, in what situation do I need to understand? Do I need to see more? Or do I need to pray? Those three things. In what situation in your life, in my life, do you need that understanding, seeing more, or to pray beyond it? Which leads to the very last thing. And you can fill this in on the blank and put it on your fridge so you remind yourself of it. How would you fill this in? This week, not sometime in the future, not forever, but this week, I commit myself to pray about. What would that be? What is it that you and I need to pray about this week? As the worship team comes up, we're going to sing a good song about who God is, actually, and it's a great way to remind ourselves when we're praying who it is we're praying to. As they're coming up, I invite you to stand as well, so stand now, and invite you to pray with me. And if you already know the answer or what you're going to put in that blank, then forget what I'm saying and just spend time praying about that. And if not, let me pray for you that you will see and you will sense what it is that you need to pray to the God of heaven about. Dear Heavenly Father, thank you so much for your word, for the story of Nehemiah, and the fact and the reality that that picture paints of a God who is sovereign and powerful, but also intimately involved in our lives. And because of that, we come to you with the things that are on our hearts right now. And we commit to pray to you, to pray beyond these things, to pray that you will be involved in our lives and in our situations, not in ways that we can control you, but in ways that we can give you free rein to do whatever you want. So, Father, I ask you to break into our lives, to work miraculously in our lives, and to draw glory to yourself. I ask that in your name. Amen.